got a spring or an itch. Pain that's swelling or twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had made me blind. It's gonna be a bright, sunshiny day. It's gonna be a bright, sunshiny day.
Well, I sure hope that I can see clearly, and I hope that you can see clearly as well. Vision is one of our five senses, and it is, at least to me, the most fascinating. It's not only how vision works that is so interesting, but the evolution of the eye, since similar organs to eyes are found in many animal forms.
We can, in fact, go all the way back to the lowly bacteria, where there is often simple light detection.
Not only that, there are other single-celled organisms, plants and animals, that react in different ways to light. In fact, complex image-forming eyes have evolved independently several times in history.
Complex eyes first appeared during the Cambrian period of evolution. That's only about 540 million years ago.
Eyes are adapted to the various requirements of their owners. There are lots of variations, such as in their visual acuity, the range of wavelengths that they can detect, their sensitivity in low light, their ability to detect motion or to resolve objects, and whether they can discriminate colors.
Charles Darwin wrote in his book, Origin of Species, that the evolution of the eye by natural selection seemed at first glance absurd in the highest possible degree.
But then he went on to say that despite the difficulty in imagining it, its evolution was, in his words, perfectly feasible if you consider that the eye evolved from a single, simple organ to one complex, little by little, by natural selection.
He suggested a stepwise evolution from an optic nerve merely coated with pigment and without any other mechanism to a moderately high stage of perfection.
In his book, Darwin gave examples of existing intermediate steps.
It is thought that the evolution of the eye came in four general stages in the evolution of a vertebrate eye from just a patch of photoreceptors.
It's thought that it took only a few hundred thousand generations of change to evolve into the complex eye that is seen in the vertebrates. Researcher G.C. Young used the fossil record to infer evolutionary conclusions based on the structure of eye orbits and openings in fossilized skulls for blood vessels and nerves to go through. All this adds to the growing amount of evidence that supports Darwin's theory. During the Cambrian period, there was much change and evolution was rapid. This is explained by something called the light switch theory of Andrew Parker.
According to Parker, the evolution of eyes started an arms race that accelerated evolution. Before the Cambrian explosion, animals may have sensed light, but did not use it for fast locomotion or navigation by vision.
The rate of eye evolution is difficult to estimate because the fossil record, particularly of the Lower Cambrian, is really poor.
So how fast did a circular patch of photoreceptor cells evolve into a fully functional vertebrate eye? Was it relatively fast?
It is now thought that the vertebrate eye took less than 364,000 years to evolve from a patch of photoreceptor cells, and that's pretty fast in evolutionary terms.
All animals with eyes share much of the genetic machinery for eye development. This suggests that the ancestors of eyed animals had some form of light-sensitive machinery, even if it was not a dedicated optical organ.
There are some pretty high levels of similarity, such as the use of the protein crystallin in the independently derived cephalopod. And those include the squids and octopi and vertebrate lenses, two different species of animals. By the way, the plural of octopus should be octopuses, because the word is derived from the Greek, whereas words that were derived from Latin usually end in I. So I should probably have said octopuses. But octopi is an acceptable plural form. Anyway, to get back to our history lesson, we often look for a link of a trait in evolution. Well, common to all light-sensitive organs are chemicals called opsins.
These opsins belong to a family of photosensitive proteins and fall into 9 groups, which already existed in the last common ancestors of all bilaterally symmetrical animals, called an orbilaterian.
There is a specific gene called the PAX6 gene that controls where eyes develop in animals, ranging from the octopuses to mice and even fruit flies. As we have implied, these high-level genes are much older than many of the structures that they control today. So they must originally have served a different purpose, being used to control eye development.
Interestingly, eyes and other sensory organs probably evolved before the brain because there was no need for an information processing organ. In other words, a brain before there is information to process.
Have you ever heard of a euglena? Well, neither did I. But the stigma, which is what we could call an eye spot apparatus, is a photoreceptive organelle found in the cells of this particular green algae. It helps the cells in finding an environment with optimal light conditions for photosynthesis. Not quite what we would call an eye, but a beginning.
Remember, these eye spots can only sense ambient brightness. They can distinguish light from dark, but they are insufficient for vision, as they cannot distinguish shapes or determine the direction light is coming from.
Eventually, the visual pigments were noted in various species. These are located in the brains of more complex organisms and are thought to have a role in synchronizing spawning with the lunar cycles. By detecting the subtle changes in nighttime illumination, organisms could synchronize the release of sperm and eggs to maximize the probability of fertilization.
At a cellular level, there appears to be two main designs of eyes, one possessed by the mollusks, annelid worms and arthropods, and the other by the chordates and echinoderm, that is the animals with at least a rudimentary spinal cord or a vascular system based on water.
The functional unit of the eye is the photoreceptor cell. Now, this is the cell that contains the opsin proteins and responds to light by initiating a nerve impulse. These light-sensitive proteins, the opsins, are born on a hairy layer which maximizes the surface area.
In the eyes of protostome, there are microvilli, which are extensions or protrusions of the cellular membrane.
But in the eyes of deuterostomes, they are derived from cilia, which are separate structures. But when did eyes as we know them first appear in history?
These eye spots permit animals to gain only a very basic sense of the direction and intensity of light, but not enough to discriminate an object from its surroundings.
Fast forward to eyes that started out as the multicellular eye patch gradually depressed into a cup, which first granted the ability to discriminate brightness in directions, then in finer and finer directions as the pit deepened. This was still the Cambrian Age, 540 million years ago.
When a photon of light is absorbed by the chromophore, a chemical reaction causes the photon's energy to be converted into electrical energy and relayed in higher animals to the nervous system.
These photoreceptor cells form part of the retina. That's a thin layer of cells that relays visual information, including the light and day length information needed by the circadian rhythm system, to the brain. Some jellyfish have elaborate eyes but no brains. Their eyes transmit a message directly to the muscles without the intermediate processing provided by a brain.
After a long period of time, evolution time, that is, reducing the size of the opening, organisms achieve true imaging, allowing for fine directional sensing and even some shape sensing.
One such animal that has this type of eye is the Nautilus. It does not have a cornea or even a lens, so they provide poor resolution and dim imaging, but are still for the purpose of vision, a major improvement over the early eye patches. Once transparent cells covered over the eyes in evolution, there was less contamination and parasitic infestation of the eye, so the area began to specialize into a transparent fluid that we now call the humor, and that allowed for optimizations such as color filtering, higher refractive index, blocking of UV or radiation, ultraviolet type, or the ability to operate in and out of water.
The cornea protects the eyeball while at the same time accounting for approximately two-thirds of the eye's total reflected power.
At some point, you may have wondered why we only see in a narrow spectrum of light, that being what we call visible light, the light in rainbows. How come we do not see other light, like ultraviolet or infrared?
Could be the eyes specialize in detecting a specific narrow range of wavelengths because the earliest species to develop photosensitivity were aquatic, and only two specific wavelength ranges of electromagnetic radiation, those being blue and green visible light, can travel through water.
Later in evolution, the lens came into being. The lens helps light from a distant object and a near object to be focused by changing the curvature of the lens. In a lensless eye, the light emanating from a distant point hits the back of the eye with about the same size as the eye's aperture. With the addition of a lens, this incoming light is concentrated on a smaller surface area without reducing the overall intensity of the stimulus. A later increase of the lens's refractive index probably resulted in an in-focus image being formed.
Soon, a liquid was noted in between the lens and the retina, and also between the lens and the outside transparent covering of the eye. The liquid originally served as a circulatory fluid for oxygen, nutrients, waste, and immune functions, allowing greater total thickness and higher mechanical protection.
In the embryo, the lens is living tissue, but the cellular machinery is not transparent, so must be removed before the organism can see. Removing the machinery means the lens is composed of dead cells packed with crystallines. And these crystallines are special because they have the unique characteristics that are required for transparency and function in the lens, such as tight packing, resistance to crystallization, and extreme longevity, as they must survive for the entirety of the organism's life.
An actual gap between tissue layers naturally forms a pan-convex shape, which is optically and mechanically ideal for substances with a normal refractive index. A biconvex lens is one that is thick in the middle and thinner at the edges. It not only provides better optical resolution, but aperture and low light ability, as resolution is no longer provided just by the hole size.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. 1-1, Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Now, we could go on and on with the minutiae of eye evolution, but we'll just go on to the birth of color vision. So getting back to water, the visual opsins in fish are more sensitive to the range of light in their habitat and depth. However, land environments do not vary in wavelength composition, so that the opsin sensitivity among land vertebrates does not vary very much.
This directly contributes to the significant presence of communication colors. Color vision gives distinct selective advantages, such as better recognition of predators, food, and mates.
It may be that simple sensory neural mechanisms may selectively control general behavioral patterns, such as escape, foraging, and hiding. All of these changes may have happened at any of the early stages of the eye's evolution and may have disappeared and evolved as organisms became predator or prey. Similarly, night and day vision emerged when photoreceptor cells differentiated into the rods and the cones.
While most photoreceptors had the ability to distinguish partially polarized light, the rachial vertebrates' membranes are oriented perpendicularly such that they are insensitive to polarized light.
However, some fish can discern polarized light, demonstrating that they possess some linear photoreceptors. Now, just like color vision, sensitivity to polarization can aid in an organism's ability to differentiate surrounding objects and individuals. Because of the, well, we'll call it marginal reflective interference of polarized light, it is often used for orientation and navigation, as well as distinguishing concealed objects, such as disguised prey.
Prey generally have eyes on the sides of their head in order to have a larger field of view from which to avoid predators.
Predators, on the other hand, have eyes in front of their head in order to have better depth perception. Take a look around you. What do you see? Well, you might see a computer or phone with a shiny, colorful screen. A piece of paper maybe under your left hand, and a sharpened pencil in your right hand. While you look at these objects with your eyes, your brain is what is recognizing the objects. Many people do take sight for granted, but how are you able to see and register these objects?
Now that we have gotten the evolution out of the way, let's look at the vision. Let's think of the eye as a sort of camera.
For your camera to work, light must come in through the lens and reach the back of the camera. When you point the camera at a flower, the sunlight that bounces off the flower enters through the lens. The lens then directs the light so that it shines onto the back of the camera. The image made by your eye or a camera is actually flipped.
Light cannot bend and must travel in a straight line because the area in the lens where light enters is very small compared to the size of the object. The light that contains the image will create an upside down and flipped picture.
Picture this in your mind. The images that are captured on your retina are also upside down, but your brain converts the information so you perceive the world correctly. So light enters the camera and the image is flipped. What's next?
Nowadays, digital cameras are more prevalent and have an area with little sensors that are sensitive to light. Sensors will collect the bits of light that comes through the camera and organize them to create a picture of the flower.
A picture is actually made from a lot of small squares called pixels. However, because they are so small, you don't see the individual pixels. When the pixel squares are put together, they will create a picture or photograph that you can see. Now, your eyes work much like a camera. Light bounces off the image in front of you and comes into your eyes through the cornea. The cornea is the clear, thin layer on the outside of your eyes. The cornea will help direct the light towards your pupil and iris. These two parts work together to control the amount of light entering your eye.
The iris is the color part of your eye, and the pupil is the little dark circle in the center of your eye. Your pupils can automatically let in different amounts of light. The pupils get bigger and smaller. This is like controlling the aperture of a camera.
Once the light comes through the pupil, it will go through the eye's lens. Just like in a camera, the lens is used to focus on an object and direct the light to the back of the eye. The back of the eye is called the retina, and it does have special sensors that are called rods and cones, which we mentioned before. Visual information excites the cone and rod sensors, with only the cones sensing color.
Nerves from the eyes connect to an area at the back of the brain, so when the cones and rods have been exposed to light, they translate the visual information into electric information.
By the way, there's an area in the eye called the fovea, pretty close to the center of the retina, that only has cones. The optic nerve will send this information to your brain. The tiny nerve cells are able to take the electric form of the image in front of you and send it to the brain's visual cortex, also called the visual center or vision center. This area is responsible for decoding the electrical information coming from the retina. This visual center interprets the electric form of the image, allowing you to form a visual map.
Because the front part of the eye is curved, it bends the light, creating an upside-down image on the retina. The brain eventually turns the image the right way up.
The retina is a complex part of the eye, and its job is to turn light into signals about images that the brain can understand. Only the very back of it is light sensitive. This part of the retina is roughly the area of a 10-penny coin, and it's packed with photosensitive cells called rods and cones. Cones are the cells that are responsible for daylight vision. Now, there are three kinds, each responding to a different wavelength of light: red, green, and blue. The cones enable us to see images in color and in detail. But rods, they're important too, because they respond to the night vision mostly. They're sensitive to light, but not to color. In darkness, the cones do not function at all. All we've got to see with are the rods.
Lens is a clear disc light structure that helps to focus light on the retina. It can do this because it's adjustable and uses a muscle called the ciliary muscle to change shape and help us focus on objects at different distances. The automatic focusing of the lens is a reflex response, and it is not controlled by the brain.
Once the image is clearly focused on the sensitive part of the retina, energy in the light that makes up that image creates an electrical signal. Nerve impulses can then carry information about that image to the brain through the optic nerve.
Most of us have around 6 to 7 million cones, and almost all of them are concentrated on a 0.3 millimeter spot on the retina called the fovea centralis.
Not all of these cones are alike. About 64% of them only respond strongly to red light, while about a third are set off by the most of green light. Another 2% respond strongest to blue light. Next week, we'll try and talk about the diseases of the eyes and the treatment of those diseases.
Refractive errors are eye disorders caused by irregularity in the shape of the eye. This makes it difficult for the eyes to focus images clearly, and vision can become blurred and impaired.
Short sight or myopia and long sight are called hypermetropia. These are very common conditions, both caused by the cornea and lens simply not focusing properly on the retina. Short sight is where the eyeball is elongated or the lens is too thick, causing the image to focus in front of the retina. Long sight is where the eyeball is too short or the lens too thin, and that causes the image to focus behind the retina. Prescription lenses can help with both long and short-sightedness. Again, next week we will talk about some of the procedures that are now available to fix this.
There are other sight-threatening eye conditions and eye diseases that are not so easily corrected, including cataract and neglected tropical diseases such as trachoma and river blindness, all of which can cause blindness if you left untreated.
Before we leave, we must tell you about a new compound that may actually offer lasting non-opioid pain relief that is effective and non-addicting. The new compound is presently called HTX-011, and it's being researched by Heron Therapeutics. The researchers randomly assigned 209 people undergoing bunionectomy and 149 people scheduled for a herniorrhaphy to one of four treatment options for pain after the surgery: HTX-011 60 milligrams, extended release, bupivacaine 60 milligrams, meloxicam, which is an anti-inflammatory, or placebo. Patients who had bunion surgery reported significantly less pain over the 72 hours after surgery using a combination medication of HTX-011 than the other three treatments. However, in those who had hernia surgery, the new compound reduced pain more than placebo and ER meloxicam, but did not significantly reduce pain compared with ER bupivacaine alone.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
com.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.